man admires as much as I do the patriotism as well as the abilities of the very worthy gentlemen who have just addressed the House.
But when Patrick Henry rose to address the Second Virginia Convention on March 23rd, 1775, here in St. John's Church, Richmond, Virginia, he spoke words that released vitality like a flame.
He seemed to have this beautiful voice, clear way of speaking and expressing himself, and a charisma that very few people in history have had.
When he said, "I speak the language of thousands," he really was speaking for thousands, and people knew it and they appreciated it.
Henry was the man who set the ball rolling for the revolution in the state of Virginia.
"Is life so dear, or peace so sweet, as to be purchased at the price of chains and slavery? Forbid it, Almighty God! I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty, or give me death."
By virtue of his birth, Patrick Henry had very little chance to become a great and noble figure in history. He was born between classes. His mother was from an old line of Virginia gentry, and his father was a Scottish immigrant. This gave Patrick a peculiar lineage, both old and new dominion.
His mother was a Winston. Her father was a well-to-do planter. She had married another well-to-do planter named John Sim. John Sim dies, and Sarah Winston Sim is a widow, and she meets John Henry. John Henry is an immigrant from Scotland. In terms of the old Virginia society, neither the Winstons nor the Winston Sim Henry family that Patrick was born into, none of those people ranked at the very top. They were not Tidewater aristocrats.
Because of his good marriage, John Henry became a justice of the peace and major in the local militia of Hanover County. Patrick Henry was born on Tuesday, May the 29th, 1736, at a Winston family plantation called Studley, near the Pamunkey River in Hanover County, Virginia. He was the second of nine children, two boys and seven girls, and he was named for his father's brother. Uncle Patrick Henry was the minister at St. Paul's Church in Hanover.
He had a very happy childhood. He had those seven younger sisters, and he liked them all. And he learned to play the fiddle. There was a very good fiddle teacher in the area. He also broke his collarbone one time and couldn't play the fiddle, so he taught himself to play the flute.
Most of young Patrick's education was informal at best. He didn't go to school.
One of the myths about Henry is that he had no education to speak of, that he was completely natural in everything he did. He did like to hunt, he did like to fish, he was apparently a normal boy. He was not an intellectual, but he was intelligent. But he did receive what seems to have been a rather thorough education from his father, who had been 4 years at the university in Scotland, and his uncle, who had a master's degree.
Throughout his childhood, Henry mixed his informal schooling with a love for country solitude. He enjoyed taking long walks through the forest by himself. This probably came from a desire to escape religious tension between his mother and father. It stemmed from an enormous religious movement that rocked colonial Virginia, the Great Awakening. In the 1740s, the established Church of England was openly challenged in the colonies by the rise of numerous religious factions. The Great Awakening had a profound personal impact on Henry because his mother and father chose to worship in different churches.
This is really a very important key to both his character and the kind of political leader that he became. His mother and most of the Winstons got involved in the Presbyterian revival. His father and his uncle, who was the Anglican minister, stayed with the Anglicans.
In 1745, when Henry was just 9 years old, the Great Awakening brought a barnstorming English evangelist, the famous George Whitfield, to preach in Hanover. Henry's mother took her children to the sermon against the wishes of Mr. Henry. It was the beginning of a tedious, tumultuous period in Virginia and in the Henry family. 3 years later, the family split widened when a second revivalist came to Hanover.
In 1748 and 49, there came a young Presbyterian minister to Hanover County. He'd been at Providence Church up in Louisa County for 1 year and then was called to Hanover. His name was Samuel Davies, and they said he was a young man with a sonorous voice and the burning words.
Davies, by all reports, was an extraordinary speaker. They said that he walked into a room like the ambassador of a mighty king. And they say that he could speak in a way he could say the one word cold and you would shiver, the word hot and you would start to sweat and squirm.
The stories are that Patrick, as a young boy, say 13 years old, old enough to drive the horse and wagon, took his mother to the camp meetings where the evangelist spoke and listened to them with great interest. And on the way home, Patrick's mother asked him to repeat the sermons to her, which I'm sure he did with a great deal of enthusiasm. And this was probably his training ground for his speaking style.
Henry went with his mother to many revivalist sermons, but he did not convert, preferring to stay within the orbit of the Anglican Church, where piety was not so strict.
Presbyterians and later the Baptists took a fairly dim view of the drinking and the dancing and the general frolicsomeness that characterized the Virginia gentry. His mother did not approve of some of his father's sociable habits. But Patrick Henry fused that evangelical style, that highly dramatic style on the one hand, with some of the old ways of gentry politics. I mean, he had his mother taking him to revival sermons, but he also could go with his father to the court days once a month when the courts were in session. And Henry, he takes something from both sides. He becomes something of a mediator between the sort of newer evangelical culture and the older gentry style. And eventually, he fuses this into a new political identity.
At an age when most young men from good families went to college, 15-year-old Patrick Henry was sent to work along the banks of the Pamunkey River, running a dry goods store for his father. It wasn't a good location, and Patrick was not a good merchant. He spent most of the time courting the ways of Virginia society. He went to plantation parties, pleasant, lazy, week-long affairs where Patrick fit in comfortably with the gentlemen and ladies of the aristocracy. In nearby Hanover, Patrick also enjoyed the trappings of the Virginia gentry. He attended revivalist sermons with his mother, studying the speeches of Reverend Samuel Davies, and court days with his father, meeting the landowners, merchants, and professionals who brought their business to the courthouse.
He was ambitious. He clearly wanted more for himself than what his father had gained in his own career in Virginia. And so he was attracted to that world of power. He was attracted to the courthouse days. He liked the action.
It was in Hanover, where his father presided and his uncle preached, that Patrick met the innkeeper's daughter.
There was a young woman named Sarah Shelton. I think she was called Sally. She was 15, perhaps 16, when they met, and I think they had a fairly short courtship. Her father owned some land in Hanover Courthouse, which is the town, including the tavern and hotel. And when Patrick and Sarah announced their intentions of getting married, he did supply them with a dowry, a farm.
Patrick was 18 years old when he married Sarah in October of 1754. Soon after, a child was born. No birth date was listed in the family Bible for Patsy Henry, but she was the first of 17 children to inherit his name. With Sarah's dowry, Henry hoped to make a living. But he had bad luck, planting 200 acres of tobacco at the beginning of a terrible drought. For 3 years, he suffered the woes of a farmer.
He had to work out in the fields with the slaves, and he almost dropped out of the gentry class.
Then his home burned down. Every last possession turned to ashes. With no money and no career, Henry abandoned his tobacco farm and moved Sarah and the children to her father's tavern, Shelton's Tavern, across the street from his father's courthouse in Hanover. And there, at the legal age of 21, Patrick Henry flourished as a keeper of the inn.
Working in a tavern like that was an extraordinary political opportunity in a way, because it put him right in the thick of things. This is rural Virginia. We're talking about people who are spread out over quite a distance, who come once a month or once every 2 weeks into this little crossroads to do their business, and it becomes something of a festival.
In this environment, Patrick Henry found his calling. His landowner status, though disastrous, gave him license to be social, play his fiddle, and converse with other men of the landed gentry. And it was there Henry developed his keen instinct for politics and the law.
He probably saw the lawyers coming into the tavern and probably went over and heard a few cases and probably said to himself, I'm as smart as those guys. I can speak as well as those guys and maybe do better. So within 6 weeks or 6 months, depending on whose account you believe, he had studied enough to be able to go to Williamsburg and get prominent jurists to sign his law license.
At the age of 23, Henry became a lawyer. For the next few years, he practiced from courthouse to courthouse throughout the colony. He solved frontier disputes, negotiated land deals, and developed a strong understanding of the people who lived in the nation's growing interior. Often, he defended the rights of religious dissenters with great compassion.
Part of his early fame had come in defending Baptists who had been very severely persecuted. It's a part of Virginia history nobody likes to dwell on, but itinerant Baptist ministers in the 1760s were spat upon, beaten, dragged out of town, harassed greatly by the Anglican and county authorities because they were seen as disturbers of the peace.
Though he was a member of the Anglican parish in Hanover, Patrick Henry's first great public speech stabbed at the heart of his uncle's church. Ironically, it was triggered by the great tobacco drought that had ruined Henry as a farmer. When tobacco harvests failed in the late 1750s, Virginia was faced with decreased tax revenues from the commodity. Needing to help the farmers, the Virginia Assembly cut salaries to Anglican ministers, which were funded by the tobacco tax. It became an emotional issue in 1762 when the Reverend James Morey, an Anglican parson from Fredericksburg, sued the colony for back pay. The case, called the Parson's Cause, was tried in Hanover Courthouse before Justice John Henry.
Patrick's father was the leading justice of Hanover County, and the justices found for the plaintiff. In other words, they said that Parson Morey had a right to collect back pay wages.
It was a long, complicated trial lasting 19 months. Patrick Henry had nothing to do with it until the very end, when the only remaining question was, how much the parson should be paid. In a moment of great irony, Henry rose before his father's court and spoke for the defense, the legislative body of Virginia, and against his father, who had ruled for the Church of England.
When he got up to speak the first time, he was rather shy, held his head down, began to mumble a little bit. His father is said to have hung his head in shame because he thought Patrick was going to make a fool of himself. But as Patrick went along, his voice rose, his head went up, his posture straightened, he threw his shoulders back, and his voice became more and more and more intense. And as he attacked the parsons, the greedy parsons, for wanting their pound of flesh, tears came into his father's eyes. He was so proud of his son.
We have heard a great deal about the benevolence and holy zeal of our reverend clergy. But how is this manifested? Do they feed the hungry and clothe the naked? Oh, no, gentlemen! Instead of feeding the hungry and clothing the naked, these rapacious harpies would, were their powers equal to their will, snatch from the hearth of their honest parishioner his last hoe cake, from the widow and her orphan children their last milk cow.
He never talked like this before, and he talked for an hour and brought forth all of these things that were bothering the people. And when the jury went out and only stayed out about 5 minutes and came back, they awarded Parson Maury one farthing.
It was the smallest possible award, equivalent to one penny. In celebration, the people of Hanover carried Henry from the courthouse on their shoulders.
It was a big political triumph for Henry. It was a tremendous performance in litigation terms and in political terms, and it launched his political career.
Patrick Henry's stunning oratory in the parson's cause sounded the alarm of discontent in Virginia. Within a year, the sugar and stamp taxes were imposed by the British Parliament. Virginia aristocrats protested, but only in discourse, not action. That frustrated the growing middle class. They sought a voice and found it in Patrick Henry. In May 1765, he was elected to the Colonial Assembly in Williamsburg, the House of Burgesses, where he embarked on a course of action that changed history.
There was a vacancy in the House of Burgesses, and his fame from the Parson Cause case, a personality, just happened to strike the right spark, and lo and behold, there he is at age 29, coming in as a freshman member of the House of Burgesses, and as has been termed, during the 10 incredible days, gives the Stamp Act speech.
I had been for the first time elected a Burgess a few days before, was young, inexperienced, unacquainted with the forms of the House and the members that composed it. Finding the men of weight averse to opposition and the commencement of the tax at hand, and that no person was likely to step forth, I determined to venture alone, unadvised, and unassisted.
Henry spent his first week as a Burgess watching the older members of the House fumble for a proper response to the Stamp Act. Only once did he rise to speak. Between sessions, Henry met with other more radical members of the House in closed council at Raleigh Tavern in the colonial capital. There, he formulated four resolutions and three conclusions on the Stamp Act.
The next time he spoke was on the 29th of May, his 29th birthday. And this is when Patrick read his resolves. If we read them, they have no great excitement. But with Patrick reading them, I'm sure that it stirred the House of Burgesses.
The four resolutions protested the act in legal terms, But Henry's three conclusions were nothing short of a declaration of economic independence.
Resolved, therefore, that the General Assembly of this colony have the only and sole exclusive right and power to lay taxes and impositions upon the inhabitants of this colony.
Henry used strong language and forceful words that rocked the assembly.
Violent debates ensued. Many threats were uttered, and much abuse cast on me by the party for submission.
But Henry did not submit. The next day, he asked to speak before the House again.
He looked severe. All this force is brought to bear on the Stamp Act protest. We don't know a lot of what he actually said.
What is known is that Henry issued an open challenge to his colleagues and a veiled threat to the Crown of England.
In former times, Tarquin and Julius had their Brutus, Charles had his Cromwell, and I do not doubt but some good American will stand up in favor of his country. And George III may profit by their example.
Treason.
If this be treason, make the most of it.
Question, Mr. President. Question, Mr. President.
There's actually no contemporary evidence that he said either of those two very witty and provocative things. Patrick Henry was an extemporaneous speaker for the most part. There are no drafts, complete drafts of any of his speeches.
What Henry actually said that day is not known because the Secretary of the House became so mesmerized by the remarkable words, he failed to write them down. One eyewitness, a traveling Frenchman, wrote that Henry backed off his threat at the point of the sword, then apologized to the members of the House, to Parliament, and to King George III of England.
He had this ability to gauge his audience, to know how far he could go as he went along. And although he obviously had an idea of what he was going to say, he had this interplay with the audience and was able to judge them, and that was much of his effectiveness as a public speaker.
Somebody said that he was Shakespeare and Garrick combined, which means that he was both the playwright, the author, as well as this very famous actor. So he wrote his own script and then he dramatized it.
Thomas Jefferson was standing in the doorway. He was in college at William & Mary, and he came to the Capitol and heard Patrick Henry make his speech and said he spoke as Homer wrote.
Henry's speech was electrifying because of its evangelical fervor, bearing all the force of America's great awakening upon the impending political crisis. His stamp-backed resolves were quickly printed, read and heard in the open courtyard of public opinion. Within months, a continental-wide protest against the tax forced the British Parliament to rescind the act. And soon after, a new slogan entered the American lexicon: no taxation without representation. During those 10 incredible days in May 1765, 10 years before the shot heard round the world, Patrick Henry fired the first salvo of the American Revolution. He served notice to the Crown of England and to everyone in the colonies that the voice of liberty would be heard. In 1765, Patrick Henry sounded the alarm of the Revolution with a Stamp Act speech. For the next 10 years of his public life, he engaged in open defiance of the British ministry, fighting for the political rights of Americans. Privately, Henry strived to maintain tranquility at home. With his family growing, he wanted to secure inheritances for his children. So he bought land, often speculating, and moved the family from Hanover to a beautiful old house in Scotchtown. He continued his law practice and took up planting again, using slave labor.
Would anyone believe I am the master of slaves of my own purchase? I am drawn along by the general inconvenience of living here without them. I believe a time will come when an opportunity will be offered to abolish this lamentable evil. Let us transmit to our descendants, together with our slaves, a pity for their unhappy lot and an abhorrence of slavery. Patrick Henry, January 18th, 1773.
But Henry's paramount domestic concern was the mental health of his wife. After the birth of their sixth child, Sarah Henry lost her mind.
I think Sarah was a manic depressive. At times she would be lucid, and other times she wouldn't. Patrick did not put her in the Eastern State Hospital in Williamsburg, which had been opened the year before. It was much more humane for her to live comfortably at home with a servant to wait on her and to be cared for.
This family tragedy filled Henry with pain. But greater work called him to Williamsburg, where he continued to voice the concerns of the people. His rhetoric grew increasingly radical. America, he said, existed in a state of nature where liberty was the common birthright of every citizen. And the Crown's attempt to deprive liberty in any form placed America in a state of war. Henry expressed this high philosophy in the words of the common man.
The essence of Henry's strategy as a revolutionary was mobilization of popular opinion, that this was going to be a grassroots rebellion. This was not a genteel separation among friends. This was a fight, and this was going to be essentially a mass mobilization. First, it was political and ideological. Second, it became military and physical.
As the 1770s unfolded, a series of choking acts descended from the British Parliament. Then came His Majesty's troops. In Virginia, a crisis came in 1774 when Lord Dunmore, the colonial governor, dissolved the Virginia Assembly. A revolutionary convention was called, and seven delegates were elected to attend the first Continental Congress in Philadelphia, including Henry. Along with George Washington and Edmund Pendleton, Henry rode the distance from Scotchtown on horseback. Once in Philadelphia, he met Sam Adams.
The two most effective revolutionary politicians in terms of really getting the revolutionary movement off the ground and becoming a full-fledged insurgency are Sam Adams in Massachusetts and Patrick Henry in Virginia.
Adams and Henry were both convinced that war was inevitable. After the Congress closed, they returned to their respective colonies to issue a call to arms. For Henry, the homecoming was bitter and cold. In February 1775, Sarah died. The next month, a second revolutionary convention was called by the Virginia Assembly. It convened on March the 20th at St. John's Church in Richmond.
There were 120 delegates from all over the state, but of course the stars of the show were George Washington, whom we call the sword of the revolution, Thomas Jefferson, whom we call the pen of the revolution, and our favorite Patrick Henry, the tongue. It is a very unusual thing to have all three of them in attendance at one place.
For 3 days, Henry did not say a word. But on March the 23rd, he came to speak.
I think he was pretty well established, the more conservative Tidewater Group in Virginia had been dealing with him for almost 10 years at that time. So they knew he was going to be a power to reckon with. He didn't come as a surprise. I think the question among them was, well, what's Henry going to do this time? And what he did was, of course, the greatest speech of his life and one of the greatest speeches in American history.
The president of the convention was constantly beating on his mallet to call him to attention. Everybody was so eager to speak. Suddenly, they came to a crashing halt when Patrick Henry got up to give his speech.
A Baptist minister witnessed the epic moment.
Henry arose with an unearthly fire burning in his eye. He commenced somewhat calmly, but the smothered excitement began to play more and more upon his features.
No man admires as much as I do the patriotism as well as the abilities of the very worthy gentlemen who have just addressed the House.
His voice rose louder and louder until the walls of the building and all within them seemed to shake and rock in its tremendous vibrations.
This is no time for ceremony. The question before the House is one of awful moment to our country. For my part, I consider it nothing less than a question of freedom or slavery.
Finally, his pale face and glaring eyes became terrible to look upon. Men leaned forward in their seats with their heads strained forward, their faces pale and their eyes glaring like the speaker's. His last exclamation was like the shout of the leader who turns back the rout of battle.
The war is inevitable. Let it come. I repeat it, sir. Let it come.
God, St. Henry, we speak for peace.
It is in vain, sir, to extenuate the matter. A gentleman may cry, peace, peace. But there is no peace. The war is actually begun. The next gale that sweeps from the north will bring to our ears the clash of resounding arms. Our brethren are already in the field. Why stand we here idle? What is it the gentlemen wish? What would they have? Is life so dear, or peace so sweet, as to be purchased at the price of chains and slavery? Forbid it, Almighty God! I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty! Or give me death!
The news just flew out of the church that Patrick Henry had given this speech, this call to arms, and we know that people gathered in the churchyard, eager to touch Patrick Henry, to just come close to him, to say, I'm with you, and to, where do I sign?
Within weeks, the first shots of war were fired at Lexington and Concord, and thousands came down from the backwoods of America to join the revolution. Many of these minute men had Henry's immortal words embroidered on their homespun clothing. It became a soldier's tradition that lasted through the Civil War. Patrick Henry's liberty or death speech was the zenith of his fame, but just the beginning of his most important work as a founding father. With the outbreak of war, Henry became colonel of the 1st Virginia Regiment. His soldiers loved him, but the new general of the Continental Army, George Washington, swayed Henry to give up his commission and remain a statesman. Henry's ego bruised, but not his devotion to the larger cause. That fateful spring of 1776, Henry came down with malaria, but kept at work, leading Virginia to sovereignty. On May the 15th, the Old Dominion became the first colony to officially declare its independence. In June, the royal governor fled Williamsburg, and the Revolutionary Assembly elected Patrick Henry the first governor of the new state of Virginia. He took the oath of office from a sickbed at Scotchtown.
The Virginia governorship, you know, it was a great compliment to Henry. It confirms his standing as the preeminent symbol of the revolution in Virginia. But in practical terms, as suspicious as they were of executive power, the Virginians, like most of the other colonies, didn't, in the transition to statehood, give their governor very much power.
Ironically, Henry had spent his entire political life challenging the power of the seat he now held. Virtually powerless, he used extraordinary legal skill to govern Virginia through the first years of revolution. Right away, he moved his family from Scotchtown to the capital, where he resided in the governor's palace. He set about procuring aid, arms, and enlistments for the Continental Army. And he sent a brash young frontiersman named George Rogers Clark to explore and defend the vast Kentucky territory to which Virginia held a claim. In 1777, Henry's period of mourning ended when he married Dorothea Spotswood Dandridge.
She was about 2 years younger than Henry's oldest daughter by his first marriage. And so therefore, she and Henry's three older children, who were all girls, were more like sisters than stepmother and stepchildren. But apparently it was a very happy marriage, and of course there were 12 children. As one historian has said, it was a home in which the cradle never stopped rocking.
In 1779, Henry retired as governor after three terms. Thomas Jefferson, Henry's friend and revolutionary ally of 20 years, was elected his successor. But by 1781, their friendship was over.
Jefferson had a personal grudge against Henry that is actually, I think, quite inexplicable. It seems to have started during Jefferson's governorship, and he had the bad luck to be governor during the worst years of the Revolution, when the fighting actually took place in Virginia. They suffered some defeats. They were not particularly Jefferson's fault anymore, that they had been Henry's fault. But when the legislature started to be critical of Jefferson, somehow he thought that Henry was behind it.
Henry had nothing to do with it, but Jefferson never spoke with him again.
Jefferson, as brilliant a man and as great an intellect and as great a man as he was admired by the people, but he was not loved by the people the way Henry was, and I think that was perhaps the basis of his envy.
Whatever the reason, or the lack of reason for Jefferson, the original quarrel, Jefferson hung on to that grudge. It does not speak well for Jefferson.
Henry remained enormously popular in the state, serving two more years as governor in the 1780s. But Jefferson's grudge had a political impact when the Founding Fathers began to frame a new government. Since 1781, Henry had supported the Articles of the Confederation and vigorously opposed any effort to centralize power. In 1787, when the first constitutional convention was called, Henry refused to attend, saying he smelt a rat. But the next year, when the new constitution was presented to the Virginia Assembly for ratification, Henry's loud, dissenting voice joined the debate, and he carried the support of the masses. James Madison, the architect of the Constitution, became worried that Virginia might not ratify. Madison appealed to Jefferson for help.
Jefferson was in France during the 1788 convention. And he wrote letters to Madison, and they said they had to pray for Henry's death because Henry was still a potent force in Virginia.
For his part, Henry worried that Madison's constitution would steal power from the people.
The loss of liberty was what terrified him. This jewel, he said in 1788, don't destroy this jewel of the people.
Will the abandonment of your most sacred rights tend to the security of your liberty? Liberty, the greatest of all earthly blessings, give us that precious jewel, and you may take everything else.
I don't think Patrick Henry has gotten enough credit for the contribution he made as a dissenter to the realization and the addition of the Bill of Rights. The fight over the Bill of Rights is the last chapter of the Revolution, and I think Henry's participation in that is an act of great civic stature.
Henry's passion influenced the mood of the debate, but not the immediate course of action. In June 1788, Virginia ratified the Constitution without a Bill of Rights. But Henry didn't give up the fight, and a year later, the first 10 amendments were adopted. Patrick Henry spent 2 more years in government, then quietly receded from the public arena. Years of protest, leadership, dissent, and continuing bouts of malaria had drained his health. By 1794, he professed no more interest in politics. That year, he retired to Red Hill, Virginia, saying it was time to see after his flock.
I think they were happy years. He worried about where the country was going. He never really felt comfortable with the strong centralized government that the Constitution gave, even though the Bill of Rights had been ratified. So he stayed at home in Red Hill and had a very nice retirement.
Many attempts were made to bring Henry back into politics. He graciously declined, citing poor health. But in 1799, George Washington asked him to campaign for a seat in the assembly. As a personal favor to the older general, Henry obliged and was unanimously elected.
He had a hold on people's hearts. He had a hold on people's imaginations that few other politicians did. And Washington had it by virtue of his stature as commander. Henry actually was more popular and loved more profoundly than Washington.
Henry never took the seat. A stomach ailment brought on by malaria ended his life on June the 6th, 1799. At age 63, the earthly work of Patrick Henry was done. Among his death papers, Henry enclosed a note reflecting on the course of the American democratic experiment.
Whether this will prove a blessing or a curse will depend upon the use our people make of the blessings which a gracious God hath bestowed upon us. If they be wise, they will be great and happy. If they are of a contrary character, they will be miserable. Righteousness alone can exalt them as a nation. Reader, whoever thou art, remember this, and in thy sphere practice virtue thyself and encourage it in others.